Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, on this episode with Eli Meyerhoff, we address the radical proposition that academia is beyond reform and that education isn't a self-evident good. Now, I know that this flies in the face of plenty of political perspectives and certainly the valorization of schools, teachers, and going to university in general. That's a valorization which constantly pits the so-called educated against the so-called uneducated, and that binds us to a sense of worth that is, of course, only attainable by getting a certification from an accredited institution, which is a tangle of corporate and state structures and interests. As someone who's gone to plenty of institutions of higher education, too many, and also who has taught at them, as well as engaged in and offered alternative modes of learning, I think about this kind of thing all the time, which is why I had to have Eli Meyerhoff on the show. Eli is researching at the Social Movements Lab and works as an organizer and is the author of Beyond Education, Radical Studying for Another World, which is an excoriating look at how academia has always exploited people and may be past the point of mere reform. I'm sure you've had your own experiences of shit in school. The last time I tried to go to school, I was pursuing an anthropology PhD here in Ireland, which was just a revelatory disaster on all fronts. It started with, the phony promise that the department was interested in guiding people into non-academic careers because it kept emphasizing, well, you're not going to be able to become an anthropology professor, so you have to do other things. But then when I said, okay, great, I'm established outside of academia and I don't want to be an academic, they had no way to deal with it. They didn't know how to wrap their heads around it, and it was just sucked for everybody. It also took the form of professors just not being able to understand the things that I said or wanted to research because they weren't directly in that mode of academic critique, which I'm going to talk about that in a second. They took the form of crazy and aggressive texts and comments from one of my professors. It was just constant. And there was also just that present and obvious devaluing of one of who I thought was the most brilliant members of faculty. Then there were just the completely unnecessary time-wasting assignments that were basically a form of labor exploitation. Except, you know, I wasn't getting paid. I was paying the university to be exploited for my time and my work. A lot of this is located in the structure of that institution and of all institutions, but also in the way that education is formed through the overly valued idea of critique and the mode of critical thinking. Here's Eli and I talking about what critical thinking ends up excluding and critique ends up excluding and how it might not be the best tool at all times.
Was it kind of like an educated ignorance, a way of knowing the world that makes us systematically ignore those features of ourselves and the institutions that we're part of that we don't want to give up?
When is it the right tool? Like, I could eat a bowl of soup with a shovel, I suppose, but like, do I want to bring that to the table? The way we learn in universities to talk with each other and to work with ideas based around critique and critical thinking affects people outside of universities, whether they've ever gone or not. The idea that that is the standard or is the way we should think about things, it's what passes for intellectualism these days, and it traces its lines exactly against the way thinking is taught in schools, which Eli points out exists primarily to circulate capital and encourage labor exploitation. I mean, I'm thinking of arguments I've had with people who aren't in academia. I really dislike having intellectual arguments in general. I find them so unnecessary. And that argument is often forced by the fact that the person is engaging with a sort of critical thinking way of talking. And I find that some people can't do anything. They can't even find a possible way to understand or engage outside of debate and critique and very certain forms, specific forms of logic. These are supposed to be tied to reason. It's supposed to be the reasonable way of looking at ideas and engaging with them and engaging with others. But far from being some sort of enlightened discourse, they simply recapitulate the right and wrong dimension of original sin, wherein someone must dominate a discussion with rightness because to be wrong is to be fallen, and you have to rise above the fallen state. And that approach eclipses the possibility of taking an interest in the other, in the self, or the topic at hand. This model of critique, which grows everywhere as a result of the way universities offer knowledge, is entangled with slavery, acculturation, colonization, and more, all of which Eli points out in his book. And that drains culture of its vitality, its possibility, and its potential. And of course, now the returns are diminishing. Academic jobs are disappearing. The focus of universities funnels itself, with tacit support from the humanities and social sciences departments, into obedience training for tech jobs. The tension of overemphasized culture wars on campus force students into defensive positions. The infantilization of adults, students interested in learning and engaging with wisdom, gets turned into overregulation of everyday life when they decide to live on campus, and more. Additionally, many of the things we'd like to study, sexuality, art, spirituality, they get reduced into theoretical dissections that remove the thrust, the layeredness, the depth that sexuality, art, and spirituality can offer. By forcing them into the Procrustean bed of critique. Because the problems are so systemic, universities that think they're doing something different often just replicate the same university model because they're focused on just teaching different topics and accepting the benefits of how ennobling that feels. I'm thinking of my very short stint at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which was just a disaster of self-indulgent courses and personalities. Many of the people that were teaching there fell prey to the thing that all professors can fall prey to, which is this guru complex of being the one who knows. But because it was bound up with this, the sense that this was truly something different because spiritual topics were being spoken about, it became far worse. And it ended up leading to a lot of wishy-washy ideas and scholarship, all in this sort of bland melange, unrigorous spirituality, environmentalism, and, I don't know, academia. As a former sex worker, I saw that there, at CIS, spirituality was granted a kind of seriousness by the university, and therefore the university could be seen as different or edgy somehow. Why did I say as a sex worker I saw this? Because it reminded me of all these academics who parasitically pretended to validate sex workers by meeting with them to talk with them about their PhD theses about sex work. Could you spare a few hours of totally unpaid labor to talk with me about sex work so I can write my PhD about it, or I can write my book as a professor about it, and therefore validate and grant you as a sex worker the status of being the subject of serious academic study? This often created a sort of illusion of, or delusion of, risk for the university or the researcher, where they got to be adjacent to something that was profound and where real learning and development and networks of thought, intellectualism, and just mutual aid and pushing culture forward were happening in sex work communities. And it's the same thing, although without the aspects of marginalization and criminalization that were happening in sex work communities, with spirituality that I saw at CIIS, that there was some kind of riskless adjacency to spiritual ideas and spiritual development that gave it a kind of puffed up feel that created more problems, because it wasn't evaluating the radical issues with education and academia. Now, listen, of course, after I've said all these pretty intense things, I want to say, of course, there are plenty of students and professors and adjunct faculty and workers who are brilliant and working through and with universities. Many of the guests on this show, in fact, are coupled with an institution, and I have my own history with institutions. The question for me is, how do we begin to move away from this shibboleth and towards connections with learning, wisdom, and engagement with the other that open us to creating a new, more loving, living, and better world, rather than just constantly funneling us back into that circulation of capital and connecting us to the ruins of the academy? So that's what Eli Meyerhoff and I talk about on this episode. I hope it offers a lot of new directions for you. Every episode of this show is free. And I don't have any sponsors, and I want to keep it that way. I think that advertisements suck, and they're just not part of the mission of this show. So if you listen to the show, you like it, there are a few episodes you like, it stirs up new ideas in you, something exciting for you, it inspires conversations in your own life, and so on, please do support the show on patreon.com/ConorHabib. It's really, really easy to sign up, and you can do a one-time annual thing, or you can do a monthly thing, whatever seems best for you. If you've heard me say this many times at the beginning of the show, then maybe this is the time where you think, oh, I should go do that. patreon.com/ConorHabib. One of the cool things about Patreon, I think, is that it's not paying somebody for their labor. It's saying, I like who you are and what you're doing in the world, and I want to be a part of it in that way. I want to be linked up to it in that way, because I think that that's how we should all be interacting with labor and getting paid and labor not being a commodity and all these things I could say at the top. But the truth is, it just means a lot to me, and it's the way that the show keeps going is through Patreon. So there you go. Now, on to a conversation against academia with Eli Meyerhoff. Here we go. Hello, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib, and hello, Eli Meyerhoff.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, so let's just jump right in. There's an essay you wrote called Abolitionist University Studies and Invitation. You co-wrote this with Abigail Boggs, Nick Mitchell, and Zach Schwartz Weinstein. And I want to quote you from this essay. An instrumentalist understanding of critique cannot account for the ways in which critique organizes us within a larger institutional framework of valuation. So there's all sorts of ways to go there, including just ideas of how to reform education and all that. But I want to talk about this matter of critique itself, the valorized property of critical thinking. Lots of students encounter it. I mean, I know I did, and it's just, we're teaching critical thinking here and how to pull things apart. I think that mode really corrals us in a certain way and can stop us from seeing the world in exciting and enthusiastic ways. And that's rarely considered. Really, it's just thought of as just a good to be able to critique things. So I want to start there with you.
The way that critique in academia and in the broader media sphere can become its own kind of way of of organizing, and it can distract us from other kinds of organizing that we might want to do if we're hoping to change the world. And academia and any sort of product of work, of academic work, can be easily commodified, and something that you might call like a radical critique, like a book or an article that somebody says is so critical that can just turn into something that they put on their CV and use to get a fancy job. Yeah, it's critique has become this kind of fetishized mode of engaging with the world. So we're thinking about how to take an abolitionist approach to academia, to universities, which doesn't just mean abolish it all or get rid of it all, burn it down. It could mean that, but we're thinking more nuanced about what it means to bring the vectors of an abolitionist movement into academia. I mean, it's already there. Think about like cops off campus organizing, or you think about organizing for ethnic studies, Black studies programs as a kind of anti-racist abolitionist organizing. But we're asking more concretely what it means for an abolitionist movement to exist and thrive and expand in academia.
Well, let's get to that in a bit, but I definitely want to stick with this critique thing more, because I think it's something mm-hmm. people don't really think about, you know, very often. Jesus said this thing about like, yeah, it was like a quip, you know, it's kind of a one-off thing where he's like, I don't really value disagreement at all. And I really, when I read that, I was like, me neither. I get what you're saying. Not because I'm always right, but because it's a certain mode of doing things. And it reminds me of the way that something has been killed or could be killed or could be hurt, rather than trying to cultivate something, some sort of resonant, you know, property. And, you know, I mean, I have people on the show all the time that they'll say things that I disagree with. And unless it's like super, super like intense for me, I'm like, I just try to go use what they say as a springboard, you know, an indicator of what direction to go in, not something to seize on and then just undo. So I think that academia is not often supportive of that move, or of any move that's not starting from this kind of dissective Cartesian place of just pulling something apart to see how it works and, you know, making your agreement or disagreement based on that analysis, you know?
Yeah. It's a kind of affect associated with critique that I think you're getting at in thinking about how it's it can be kind of a sad depressing kind of affect of it's like, yeah, tearing things down, destroying things, ending things. It can be sad in the sense, like Spinoza's sense of reducing our capacities, our collective capacities to do things in the world. And that the opposite of that for Spinoza's joy, a joyful kind of affect of expanding our capacities to do things together in the world. I think, along those lines, I'm getting this from Carla Bergman and Nick Montgomery's book called Joyful Militancy, where they talk about trying to get away from a critique-based mode of theorizing the world in favor of an affirmative mode of theory, or affirmative mode of engaging the world, affirming what people are doing that's alternative to the dominant oppressive ways of being in the world. Mm-hmm. So they're not saying get rid of critique wholesale, but try to do more affirmative kinds of ways of engaging, of affirming alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like two things come up for me. One is like, yeah, it's not against critique so much as like, when is it the right tool? Like, I could eat a bowl of soup with a shovel, I suppose, but like, do I want to bring that to the table, you know? And then also, I was just thinking about if it can, if academia can really endure the loss of that as the predominant mode at all. Like, and that reminds me of you were hinting at this before, another line in that essay that you co-wrote, which is, what would an abolitionist approach to the university say yes to? Because even the just sort of mode of talking in the university is a mode of no in a lot of ways. So that there's a rejection. And it's interesting because I think people who are activists and organizers really value the tactic of refusal and saying no to things. But like, it's somehow like academia can just drain the no and the refusal of its vitality and just filter it into these dead end kind of eddies of examination or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And in that kind of saying no and fetishizing critique, it's kind of like a shadow subject that is produced. It's kind of like an implicitly produced critical academic, professional critical academic who's skilled at critical analysis and refusing in smart sounding ways. And I think there's kind of systematic ignorance that's kind of a shadow of that critical mode of being. It's kind of like an educated ignorance, a way of knowing the world that makes us systematically ignore those features of ourselves and the institutions that we're part of that we don't want to give up. So like, yeah, one's own complicity with the oppressive features of academia and the education system more broadly, that like sense of oneself as like a really good critical subject, like has this kind of shadowing of the ways we're complicit with the violent features of the education system.
We don't have to necessarily go on the magical mystery tour that I'm always interested in taking here, but I will just say, like, one of the things that I view, you know, the university as, and I've gone to a bunch of them now, is like, it's like an anti-mystery school. So in the sense of like, you know, in spiritual terms, it's, you'd enter into this like intense process of spiritual development, which would, you know, realign your perspective and orient you towards reality in a different way and make you of use to your community and people around you in a certain way. And it's like, I feel like, I didn't feel like this as an undergrad, but definitely the times I went to grad school or tried to again go to grad school, because some people never learn, I thought like, wow, this is actually this is serving the purpose of blocking the mystery for me. Like, it's not allowing me to have that mystery mood about anything. And, you know, this was really brought to light when I had an advisor here at the school. I was going to get a PhD in anthropology at here in Ireland. Actually, she was the head of the department, and she was just kind of fed up with how I was conducting my affairs. And she said, you know, I know that you think that you would like to do some important, valuable work for the world. And I want you to know, it's our job to stop you from doing that. You're supposed to seek admission into a society, and that's what you're here for. I was like, fuck. I mean, it was laid very plain, but it was like, okay. I saw it then, and I realized how incommensurable my own goals were with, you know, the goals of the department or the university. And that was anthropology, which is where you'd hope there would be the most sort of hopeful kind of look at things in a lot of ways, these days, at least the way anthropology appears now. But so I think why I'm bringing that, and maybe you can run with this spiritual version if you want, but maybe the secular version, I'm reminded of like the, there's an essay called Walking Out on the University by William Rowan Thompson, where he wrote, what does he write? The call for it, and this speaks to the reform within thing. The call for reform within becomes one of the cleverest devices to preserve the structure. Reformers fancy that by opening up the curriculum to subjects that seem relevant to youth, such as poverty, abortion, or gay liberation, they'll create a healthy university, but all they will really be doing is offering sociology 101, 102, 103. The culture of the university remains the same. So that's how it does it to activism and political and social concerns. Like, it just kind of stuffs them into these quantitative, you know, ladders.
Yeah. 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 Pick up on what you're saying about spirituality and the kind of limiting of kind of curious, broad spiritual exploration that happens in academia. I think this is something that's endemic to not just academia, but to the whole world of education, the whole education system, where there's this kind of there's kind of a normative mode of spirituality implied in the very infrastructure and way of imagining the education system that we have in all Western countries, all Euro-American countries and white settler countries, that it's this imaginary of an individual rising up the levels of the education system from preschool through kindergarten through the lower elementary to upper elementary, up the grade levels, up to higher education, and conversely avoiding dropping out. So that idea of the dropout is kind of the converse kind of waste subject who's opposed to the figure of the rising graduate. And after higher education, continuing to rise in academia into this elite society of the tenure track, rise up the tenured ranks and into whatever higher elite society they can be admitted to. And that is a spiritual mode of being, and nobody acknowledges that it's spiritual. But if we so this thinking about this was like a main motivation for me to get into my book Beyond Education, because I was like really struck by how people tend to take for granted the idea of the school dropout as like a bad thing, a bad figure. And I was like, there's this weird kind of like vertical imaginary behind that. Where does that come from? And so I looked into the history of that. And like originally it was this spiritual idea that these religious converts called the Brothers and Sisters of the Common Life in like 1300s and what was called Lower Germany. It was like a spiritual, what they called spiritual ascent up the levels of school, and they created these levels of school in their schools. It was the first like instance of like age divided level schools, and that spread from them across Europe. Because originally this very spiritual idea, and it's very limiting. It's this kind of vertical imaginary. It limits possibilities for exploring the world in like following our innate curiosity or young people's innate curiosity in more anarchical, horizontalist ways.
No, I mean, I love that you point out that in your book, that illusion of verticality, because it is right. It's like an outpicturing of what is supposed to happen spiritually. So it mirrors the forms and sort of organizing around spirituality that most lend themselves to structures of power, whether it's Scientology, like going through all these like sort of clearings through, you know, Catholic Church hierarchy, like all that kind of stuff. It's like it very much matches those forms. And, you know, whereas if we were to talk about some kind of inner development that didn't lend itself to that, that actually made us feel more connected to people, more responsible for all of us, you know, at the same time as we were developing our individuality. That's just a completely different, field. But I was thinking when you were talking as well about like the, it's that book on Kings by David Graeber and Marshall Sullins, where they're like, you know, we tried to rebuild the hierarchies of the spiritual world here. And what we ended up doing was creating this really horrible thing. Like when we try to sort of echo how we think the spiritual world works and just recreate it in forms and hierarchies, it ends up being terrible for everybody. You know, I mean, that's part of the proposition. I don't know that they would have framed it that way, but when I said it to David that way, he was fine with it. So I'll just accept that that's okay. But I mean, I think it's like, you know, that is that. And it starts, as you point out, it's like just ascending the grades. And I do find that, like, because actually what's happening, as many anarchist thinkers and have pointed out, is like, you're just sort of flensing away the things that would... you're actually just removing things and making people more obedient over time in some ways, or funneling them into certain kinds of career paths that help that circulating of capital, which you bring up again and again. And I do want to talk about that as well, because I mean, it's just a great point where you, you know, Murray Ross, who was the founding president of York, this is something else that, well, and Thompson points out, he said, you know, that the university is just a large public corporation, and therefore people live in large public corporations for 4 years or whatever. So maybe we can talk about that, the way that that verticality assists in circulating capital and labor exploitation along the way as well. And then maybe we can get back to some more of the content of education a bit.
Yeah. I think this is like, been a core question for me, and I'm still exploring it, about how this verticality of education and the kind of school and university infrastructures, how that like vertical imaginary, how it's related with capitalism. And it definitely is. It's hard for me to piece it out carefully, but I think it helps maybe to think about alternative, like radical alternative ways of making the world in contrast. Looking at indigenous peoples' ways of life, there is a much tighter relationship between people and the land, and their cosmologies and their understandings of themselves and their relations with the world. Capitalism has been intimately tied with colonialism because it, capitalism requires constant expansion, accumulation of land as a way to solve its own internal crises by expanding onto new land and taking indigenous people's land. And in doing that, the indigenous peoples are separated from their land. Political theorist Glenn Coulthard talks about this in his book, Red Skin, White Masks, where he talks about the dispossession of indigenous peoples from their land as a form of separation of individualized producers from the means of production, where the land is a major kind of means of production. If we contrast that kind of situation of the capital relation of individualized producers separated from the land, contrast that with indigenous peoples' ways of relating with the land, where they see their ethical community as formed in reciprocal relationships with the land and other non-human beings, and they understand their sense of self, their sense of spirituality through these kinds of reciprocal relationships. And I think that's kind of like a radical alternative imaginary to the sort of the vertical imaginary of individualized self rising through the educational levels. And for like a great concrete example of these indigenous ways of studying with the land in a kind of reciprocal relationship, Glenn Coulthard is part of, I think he was a founder of this school called the Dishinta Center for Research and Learning, where they're supporting indigenous ways of life through learning with indigenous elders and young people.
Right. So obviously most universities must consider land to be a commodity in some way, it's definitely not part of the equation for indigenous people, because there are indigenous people who view land as commodity too. But in what you're talking about, that's not part of the equation. But I also think it's like, I'm thinking about time. As you know, this time progression, because I'm thinking about the ways in which capitalism and certain, you know, forms of money and economy stimulate an idea of time or an experience of time, which is really definitely reliant on a kind of curtailed version of the future. Like if you're just thinking about debt, you're catastrophizing constantly, you're saving up to accumulate value of something by not circulating it, but just holding on to it, all that kind of stuff. That all relates to creating a certain idea of time, which definitely has to do with also progressing through life in a certain way. Whereas, you know, it's clear, even from talking to some people I know who are indigenous or partly indigenous, like there's a different concept of time very many instances, where even cause and effect like are experienced or talked about at least or conceptualized differently, so that you don't have that kind of one thing after another after another after another, which is like really an Aristotelian idea. It's like, oh, well, we get one thing and then we get the next best thing in knowledge. We learn something, then we learn the better thing and we throw the old thing out and we learn the better thing. It's like this whole kind of progression that's not, you know, allied with like the way a lot of people experience the world, that kind of time sense. So sorry to go off on that tangent, but I was just thinking of it. Right. You were talking about it spatially and I was thinking about it temporally, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's that's a big difference of capitalist time from many indigenous people's conceptions of time, where time is not something that can be abstracted from space. Rather, it's always grounded in particular places and bodies. So there's not this kind of dichotomy of space and time, which that dichotomy has been used by colonists to justify colonialism, like saying that people from a certain space are behind in time, behind in history, compared to Europeans. Thinking about time, I've thought about this in the university, how a kind of capitalist view of time keeps people locked into kind of machine-like way of life, where some people's more enjoyable experiences are dependent on or co-constituted with other people's experiences of exploitation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a temporal architecture. It's the term I get from Sarah Sharma, the book In the Meantime. this this way of being in the university and in capitalist life generally, that where some people, like tenured faculty and administrators, get to enjoy a kind of slower pace of life, mm-hmm. While like in order to write books and be critical scholars, but their sense of like slowed down temporality is interdependent with the sped up time of so many other people who work in like the like just-in-time delivery industry of like Amazon workers or like service workers who are constantly being pushed to speed up the productivity. Yeah, and I think temporal architecture is a way to actually bring time back into relation with place, like thinking about how certain like built environments, built material infrastructures of the university and the surrounding city, like, you know, lock us into a sense that way of relating temporally.
Yeah, I love what you just said, because you can sort of imagine like the people with tenure and certain admin people just sort of moving, like if you just sort of stand back and imagine them moving very slowly, whereas like the adjunct professors and the students and the staff are just like moving around like really intensely, and you can see them feeding the energy into the slow field, you know. You can almost have the picture of it, and you know, it's like of course I'm saying that I, you know, well, I hope people understand that. Of course I'm saying I want everybody to have access to whatever form of time they want. It's not that I'm condemning the slow time person and trying to valorize like the sped up, you know, because they're the ones that are suffering or whatever. But then you do get all these different pictures, right? Like students staying up like super late at night to like study, or just to actually have a social life because they're studying all day and doing this labor. That's just unpaid labor. And I think that's a big revelation for people, that like schoolwork is unpaid labor, that that's labor, and it's not seen as such because it's cycling into, as you point out, the accumulation and circulation of capital, the expropriation of labor, the non-circulation of wages, that it's sort of keeping the whole thing going. So I love this idea of time and slowness and speed that you're talking about, like that somehow is feeding into certain kinds of circulations. But you almost think like, you know, if I just stuck a bar in the spokes of that, you know, that wheel of speed that was happening, like everything would kind of collapse and find its own new time slowness speed level, you know?
Yeah. And that happens when people go on strike.
Yeah, exactly.
Or when students occupy a campus. There's rearranging of temporal relations. Kind of converse figure of the temporal architecture as like a spatial clockwork. So like the clockwork of the university stops, mm-hmm. throw their bodies in the spatiotemporal machinery of the university.
Into the gears.
Yeah.
Into the Charlie gears. Chaplin. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think in those moments of occupation and strikes, we have people experience alternative ways of being. I was just reading a book on Family Abolition by Emmy O'Brien. She starts out with the scene of Oaxaca commune, which was like a major long-term strike by teachers, where they stopped the machinery of the education system for months. But in their strike, on the strike line, they were engaging in alternative ways of being, communistic, mutual aid mm-hmm. kinds of ways of being, and alternatives to the family also. I mean, they're like breaking out of the kind of privatizing of care that happens in the family and the heteropatriarchal gender relations of the family. like doing that kind of domestic care that normally happens in privatized families, doing that like on a strike line, like cooking food mm-hmm. together, caring for each other's children together, and doing time, spatiotemporal relations in a really different way also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's also like, I'm just also thinking about how all of that structure, it keeps people really, you know, I mean, this is just probably an overall critique of capitalism, but when we talk about in the university, it's like keeping people so active up to a certain point that, you know, by the time they get to tenure, they're like, oh, I can finally relax into this thing that I've been trying to achieve all along. So they're thoroughly inculcated by the time they get to the, I mean, no disrespect to a lot of people probably who I've had on the show who are tenured professors who I really like and whose work I'd like, but you get to the point where you're like, oh, now I can finally, you know, be valued for who I am. I was thinking about this professor that was at that school that I had mentioned before, who, God, he was just brilliant. Like he was a brilliant guy. I could listen to him talk for hours, which in fact, if you took his class, that's all you did, is he just would talk for 2.5 hours. But I loved that, like, because he was just dizzying. He was so interesting. But I could also tell that he had found himself located in the only place that he felt could value that. You know, I mean, he was in this position where, you know, yes, he was secured, but he would probably just like rush through that system like so hard and so intensely. And now he's at a place where he feels valued. So there's two things I think at play here. One is the way in which the structure of that vertical structure, the temporal structure that we're talking about, all of that plays into people not feeling valued until they get into that slow time space, you know. And the only other instances are they're like, well, one student told me that I was great or this or whatever. It's like this always like outward facing affirmation from others, but like it's hard to feel, you know, give yourself an affirmation of your own interests and work. So you get to the tenured place and you're like, finally. But then also like just the way that culture is and the way that things are set up outside of the university is like people like that professor I mentioned, they don't feel that they have a place of value because all that learning and brilliance is corralled in the university system. And we're told that that's the only place that you can have it at all. And that if you know off the top of your head, every anthropologist and every philosopher, and you can just say these things and string together all these interesting points of view and philosophies, you're just going to be the crazy person in your basement, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, if you're not doing the practice every day of engaging in movements with movements and like testing out your ideas in collaboration with others, like what, yeah, what, of course, after 10, 15 years on the academic vertical track, of course, your ideas aren't going to resonate because you haven't been practicing, like rehearsing with them. I'm picking that up from this book, Rehearsals for a Living, by it's kind of like a conversation between Robin Maynard and Leanne Simpson. They talk about the importance of practice, organizing practice as a kind of rehearsal. Like it's something we're testing out, experimenting with, and we'll make mistakes together, but that's okay because we're in community together and learning together. And I think there's like a fear that academics have of being wrong or not having the most brilliant critique or being critiqued by others that can like make academics feel comfortable in that academic world and fear putting themselves out there in relation with movements. But if you don't do that, if you just stick in that comfort zone for your whole life, you're going to get stuck in it.
You must feel that creeping in sometimes, you know, I mean, I realize you're probably one of the things that probably safeguards against it is being connected to broader like networks and friendships and relationships of activism and learning and all that kind of stuff. But I still imagine that being in it, like, has the feeling of it creeping in sometimes.
Yeah. I think, I occupy a kind of marginal place on the edges. I feel the desire to be in it and get an academic kind of position. But I've been kind of gradually rolling out or being pushed out over many years. I think I've been out of grad school now for 10 years. And I've adjunct taught for 3 years of that time. But the past few years, I've worked as a staff person, like an event planner, basically, mostly working for professors. I have a kind of split subjectivity where I still desire the good stuff about academia, but I've seen its seedy underbelly, and I'm pretty disgusted with it mostly now. What I've been working on the last year or so has been creating a school, a kind of alternative school for younger folks. It's like a kind of anarchistic type of school, a democratic free school, a model called an agile learning center, which gives kids a say in what they're learning and how the school is run. They get to do kind of, it's like a place where young people get to do self-directed learning in community with others, and like the adults in the space are there to provide resources and guidance to help them out, but like not to tell them what to do.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. I think that more and more of those, like more and more alternative models are happening. I mean, because of a lot of problems you identify and the directions you indicate we can go in, you know, Svetchko Horvat and Franco Bifo-Baradi and Pamela Anderson has started this new school in the Adriatic Sea. And there's a new skills building school here in Ireland that's opening up. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of that kind of stuff happening because people are seeing, I mean, it might also just be a result of people seeing that their education isn't going to make them stand out in any particular way anymore, that really, you know, it's diminishing returns for having a degree. And I know that you don't locate all the problems with education there, and you talk about the sort of history of that, or you write about the history of that in your book. But I think the idea that we would get a job based on the fact that we had a degree. Now the degree is a necessary component of getting any kind of job anywhere or whatever, or that you would go to grad school and then become an instructor. Interestingly, I mean, for me, again, in that grad school experience, I was like, I don't want to be a professor. And so even though they had all this sort of like, every single talk they gave to students was like, well, there are lots of other opportunities available for you, and you can do this, you can do this, and maybe you need to think about the practical applications for this in the world. As soon as someone showed up and was like, yeah, I don't want to do that pipeline. I don't care. I'm set. I'm doing okay in my own life. I don't need it. They actually had no idea how to cope with it or handle it or whatever. So that quickly revealed to me that it was also about something more than just that. But I do think that that's some of it is this sense of diminishing returns from even getting an education in the first place, as far as the clout it gives you and credit, but also what you'll even get out of your education if you go to school.
I think there are other reasons also that young people like to go to college. I think a big one is an escape from work. Mm-hmm. Or I mean, it still is a kind of unwaged work, doing schoolwork, but compared to exploitative wage work in like an Amazon warehouse, there's something more liberatory feeling about doing schoolwork, or not just schoolwork, but all the other stuff that happens in college, like making friends and going to parties and experimenting with your sexuality and your identity, your exploring your ideas of who you are and what you want to do, what you could do in the world. So yeah, there's something about colleges, universities, and schools generally that I think we could hang on to or want to hang on to if we got rid of all of the capitalist statist oppressive aspects of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see the things that it offers and say, how do we, yeah, I mean, that's your whole project, is entangling the things that it could offer and also finding new directions for it. But yeah, and I think that we should talk about the conditions for students on campus that are trying to experience that. Again, that William Irwin Thompson essay where he calls it a Dionysian bureaucracy. You know, it's like there are all these opportunities for freedom, but they're increasingly regulated and limited by all sorts of other apparatuses. All the things that you had brought up that students might be excited to go to school for, those are getting also increasingly regulated or shifted around. I used to give talks on college campuses about, I don't know why people asked me, because I was doing sex work, I guess, but they asked me to like come and give talks about consent, which I always thought was really weird because it was like their only way in sometimes to being able to talk about sexuality on campus. Mm-hmm. And I would always read the code of conduct manual of the university before I went. And I was like, this is like absolutely wild. Every time I was like, every sexual experience on this, you know, campus is like a menage a trois with the person who wrote the code of conduct manual that like, it just is obviously written to protect the university, you know, and has nothing to do with the experiences that the students are having or want or desire. And like navigating that seems like a hellscape. I mean, it's obviously, it's good to have some laid out idea of consent going into sexual experiences, but the way that the university was treating it seemed crazy. So that's one piece, that's the sexuality piece. But I think we could talk about them in terms of all the other things that the students are going to school for are becoming increasingly regulated with fear of harm to the economic apparatus and capital of the university.
I think we could see this kind of increasing regulation of students out of fear for the university's bottom line, that they're worried about lawsuits, they're worried about losing tuition dollars if students go elsewhere. I think it helps to think about about this kind of profit accumulation focus is not a new thing, but it's having a long history rooted in the university's functions for capitalism more broadly. This is something we look at in our abolitionist university studies work, looking at how after the Civil War in the US, the world of or the institutions of capitalism all had to change in order to adjust to the new situation in the US of not having enslaved people's labor to rely on as a source of massive profit accumulation that capitalism entered a crisis of accumulation and needed new means of accumulation. These new means of accumulation included prisons and policing and racist, institutionally racist workplaces as ways to increase the exploitation of workers through using race as a kind of wedge in the working class. But then also we could think of how universities changed also to help capital find new means of accumulation also. So I think one major way that they did that, and they still do that, is by sorting and differentiating the labor power of students who graduate from them. Like racist and sexist forms of discourses were also created by universities or by academics in universities as a further way of sorting and hierarchically differentiating people's labor power. Grading and credentialing is a big part of that also. I think we can think about how the current ways that universities are trying to accumulate profit as like extensions of that earlier history, rather than having nostalgia for some kind of like earlier golden age of the university that we need to get back to.
Yeah, well, that's something you point out again and again, which I really love, which is, you know, there's this idea that things were good, you know, and it's almost just like an argument for the humanities in a way. It's like things were good because humanities department people could get hired after they left. And, you know, there were a lot of famous authors and philosophers who were working in universities, particularly after World War II. And so things were like pretty great. And now, and we need to get back to that because that's where that golden age was. But as you just sort of point out, you're like, no, it was always like, there's always a problem. but since there was always a problem, and I think you can identify it. So it's like the valorization of the past, like the past is like just that valorized past is just actually a made up thing. I mean, I can locate that there were more exciting professors as far as I'm concerned at some of the schools I went to before I got there who had, you know, recently retired in the early 2000s or the late 90s or whatever. But that's not touching on the structures and any of the, you know, and all the systemic abuses and all that sort of stuff. It's not bringing any of that up. So maybe the invention of the noble past of the university is something that we should talk about just for a moment here, because I think a lot of people, even up to this point in the conversation, who are listening might be like, well, yeah, but things were good at one point, right? And again, I think you and I are not saying there's nothing good about how anything at universities, but like, let's not result to these illusory notions.
The kind of trope of a noble past is a longstanding narrative, Jeremiah-ic stories about how things used to be better. Just need to get back to that. And it's, yeah, I think we just need to understand that always universities have been terrains of struggle. Like even in times of slavery, when enslaved people were forced to work on university campuses, those enslaved people struggled. They escaped. They refused to work. They went on strike. They had forms of struggles, and yeah, in their struggles and organizing together, they were and forming lives their lives together. They were enacting alternative ways of being to the white supremacist capitalist university in the broader world that it was a part of. So I think, and looking back at these kind of nostalgic narratives for the university, I think it's helpful to not just reject them, but to think about how the people who were telling them were responding to the struggles of people who have been marginalized, people who are struggling from the bottom up and who were creating alternatives. You think of those nostalgic narratives as kind of reactions to people's struggles.
When people think about the struggles of the university now, there's always just that culture wars idea that comes up. And while I think that some of that, of course, is worthwhile, and I experienced versions of it myself as a student with my varying identities that came into the classroom long before there were like online cultural wars and that sort of stuff as well. So I do think there are real concerns there. Some of it is really important, but you know, we're talking about the overall structure, and yet the thing that gets focused on so much are these other problems and, you know, these cultural war problems on campus or whatever. And it's hard to talk about those in the light of the things that I think we're talking about without it sound like we're diminishing some of the importance that happens in those spaces. But then also I do kind of want to, in some ways, not diminish, but reduce the emphasis on those issues and conflicts in a way that only because they seem to eclipse these other, you know, overarching structural issues of like, well, what happens in the, of course, these kinds of conflicts happen in these structures, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like, we want to talk about the culture and the conflicts, the political conflicts around culture, but we don't want to do it in a way that distracts from the kind of other political, economic problems that are tied with universities. I think that's what the right wing wants to do. And in liberal responses, they often play into that narrative by just focusing on the culture. I think a more anarchist socialist kind of response would be to talk about how the cultures are embedded in material ways of life and related with broader political economic issues. So in how the right is focusing on what they stereotype as critical race theory in the U.S., they try to like make it seem like just a matter of representation, or they kind of like link together CRT with diversity and inclusion programs or trainings and safe spaces. So they in doing that, they're disembedding critical race theory and other anti-racist academic ideas and work from disembedding that from the social movements of the long Black freedom movement and other radical anti-racist movements, Chicano movement, indigenous anti-colonial movements, like disembedding those ideas from these broader movements that sought to dismantle racial colonial capitalism and enact alternative ways of world making. I think that liberal responses to those right wing attacks often get caught up in this kind of disembedded cultural discourse because they're not ready to let go of capitalism and explore the alternative kinds of world making projects of those radical anti-capitalist, anti-colonial kinds of movements.
Yeah, it's
Right. They're a set, you know, I mean, the call and response are a set that are just making things worse. I think I sometimes think of it as like, you know, cause I have friends who are professors and instructors, and the stuff that's coming up in their classes is sometimes like ridiculous to me, like from my viewpoint. Who knows how I'd feel if I were in that classroom, cause I've made statements like that myself when I'm in class, but like they seem sort of absurd to me. And I sometimes wonder if it's like some of these concerns about exact language, about you know, the sense of identity that is occurring on campus. One, I think those are all intensified by some of the problems we've already addressed, but I think that's like it's people seeking comfort in a place that is not offering them that much more. When like the educational apparatus is eroded, when the structure is exploitative, when you don't know you're going to get a job out of any of this, when you know you're going into debt for it, why would you not seek to make things as accommodating to your own sense of self as possible in that environment? So of course you would be very specific and particular about how people spoke around you, who you interacted with, what kinds of relationships were in play, and the languaging around those relationships, because what the hell else are you going to do? I would want to be comfortable in that and feel completely unthreatened in that environment too, because I knew it was accumulating threat for me later in life with debt and with, you know, searching for jobs and with a sense of having blown 4 to 12 years on this thing or whatever it is, you know? And the other thing that comes up a lot, it doesn't come up quite so much anymore, but used to come up a lot more when it came to academia, is jargon. And look, like you and I have already done it, like in this talk, you do it in your writing. I've done it. It's like, you know, imaginaries, world making, you know, and that like citation anxiety where I'm like, well, as Gilles Deleuze said, and in this essay by so-and-so, and we do that. And I want to call us out for doing it, you know, not because I think we've done some horrible thing here. We're entering into conversation with each other, and these are the terms that we know and like and use. But I do think it does need to be talked about, because I do think the access to information, it's not because people are I hate the idea that like people couldn't possibly understand it, but rather that it does create a sense of intentional gatekeeping or arm's length, you know, to people who might want or find exciting and, you know, entry points with academic work and courses and that sort of stuff. So I do want to talk about that. It used to be something that people really addressed a lot more, but they don't address it so much now, I don't think.
Yeah. I think something that, here you go, doing this again, but name dropping with Fred Moten and Stefano Harney in their very jargony titled Under Commons essay. Yeah. or I forget if it's an essay or in the broader book, but they use this language of thinking of concepts or words as toys that we can play around with, sometimes tools that we can do work with together, sometimes toys that we can experiment with together. And I'd also say sometimes weapons that we could deploy in more conflictual kinds of interactions with people who are more our enemies. But thinking of words in that way, in the concepts that we're trying to imply with words, like think of them as toys or tools. Like how are they, you can ask yourselves, how are they circulating with the people who we're playing with and working with? I ask myself this question when I I use terms that could not resonate with somebody else, that could feel jargony to somebody. If the people who I'm collaborating with, playing around with, if they aren't feeling the language, if they don't pick it up, then it's not useful. It's not helping us compose a better world together, and it's not helping us dismantle this shitty world. I guess in thinking about that, I'm also influenced by Bruno Latour, or actor network theory more generally, where they have this really materialist understanding of language, where you think of how words circulate in the world, or think of how theories circulate in the world. Are people subscribing to them or not? If not, then it's not very useful. And I think this gets back to our earlier discussion about academics feeling comfortable in academia, too comfortable, and getting kind of stuck, and not feeling comfortable enough to engage with movements and people outside of academia. I think when academics get caught up in academic circles, they can get too comfortable with using jargon that only other academics understand. I use some of this jargon, like the world making term particularly. I feel like that term has recently had like a wider circulation among like abolitionist activists. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a term that I feel like it's kind of like a term that appeals to people who already can see the possibility of alternatives to capitalism, and it feels jargony. I still feels jargony to anybody, but because it's not commonly used, but I think it has that potential to help people like see the capitalist world as one alternative world among other possibilities. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kind of keep using it, even though it's jargony.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I mean, I don't have an issue with you using any kinds of terms at all. I do it all the time, and you know, I'll often have these moments where, I mean, look, I, when I talk about spiritual stuff, like, I mean, really, the vocabulary is completely different, and like, you know, like 3% of the world has any idea what the fuck I'm talking about. So I try to do this thing where I'm just like, all right, and nobody that's listening knows what we're talking about right now. Let's back it up and let's, you know, pull these terms apart. But then also, I don't always want to do that, because I'm like, I want to be free to go wherever I want. And we don't actually have to understand each other to have this conversation. Like, in fact, some of the joy of the conversation is that we won't understand each other, that we won't know where we're coming from. And, you know, and part of that thing with critique is, you know, that we were talking about right at the beginning, is like, it demands that you be right in a way. It demands that you understand in the proper way. And I find that so unfree. I mean, that's so dismissive of the individuation that we all experience, our own perspectives and our own interpretations. So in some way, I like that we're not always going to get it from each other. But then there is also the way in which that insularity can be a block to organizing. Like, why should it be so hard, just because we're not all using the same words, for critical theorists, cultural theorists, Marxists, anarchists, people who are into philosophy, people who are into occultism, whatever, like, to come together when they do have similar value systems a lot of the time, just because the language is different. I find that a little wild. And so my interest is more like, well, what do we do about that? Not should we just banish the jargon because it might have value. And I think that value is important, personal value, but how do we sort of decelerate its tendency to stop us from organizing, from coming together?
Yeah. I think a quote I think about a lot is this quote from Gustav Landauer, that the state is a certain way of relating, and to get rid of the state, we need to relate differently. I think about that for the university also. That's a way of relating. You want to do something different, we need to relate with each other differently. Just this thing of centering our relationships with each other, and asking who are we in relationship with? Who do we want to get into relationship with, and how do we want to relate together? And that kind of perspective, I think, makes me always concerned about what language I'm using in my interactions with anybody. Are we already in relationship with each other? And if so, maybe it's okay for us to use language that only we know. And that might be alienating to others. But if we're talking to other folks we don't know that well yet, then we probably don't want to use specialized language, and we want to use more broadly accessible language if we want to build relationships with others. And thinking about all the other things beyond the language, like how do we make the place where we're at a welcoming and joyful place for the people who we want to be in relationship with? Do we have food at our meeting? How do we welcome people into the meeting? How do we get to know each other and build a relationship?
Yeah, I think about, you know, there's this idea that I can sort of dance with both ways. One is that we should be, you know, clear about our terms before we offer, you know, organizational relationship with people. And I get that. Obviously, it's like you don't want to be helping out someone who is counter to your aims ultimately, or who isn't making a radical enough argument or looking at structural problems or whatever. But on the other hand, I also feel like for me, I, at a baseline, and this might sound wild or probably piss some Marxists off, but I have solidarity with everybody, you know? And I think that for me is an abolitionist or restorative justice stance, where it's like, I'm fighting for those who are fighting against me at the same time. Like, I am with you. And the question for me is how to work this out. And that's not always going to be clear. And my solidarity shouldn't end just because my imagination isn't capable of finding a way to embrace or work with you. Not because I'm like, well, let's give the fascists a way in, but I'm like, well, my solidarity can be with someone at the same time figuring out how to create a world without fascism where that option is not resorted to. And that is not about a person. That's about a structure, a system, a perspective, a way of seeing. And then also ultimately finding ways to hold people accountable that don't, you know, turn into fascism at the end. That is a kind of solidarity that's like, well, I think you need to stop doing this, but I'm not going to resort to punitive or cultural models to deal with you. Like, that is a kind of solidarity, I think. I was just thinking about that sort of back and forth between those two things when we're talking about how to talk with each other, how to meet with each other, relate, have some kind of solidarity before clarification even exists, you know?
Yeah. Thinking about how the person who we're engaging with has been made through their relations with all other kinds of people and institutions and systems in the world, and thinking about how we have a potential for being in a good good relationship with them, even if we're not now, there's the possibility for changing the world that made them that way, and that they might desire that too, but we don't know until we try.
So coming to the end here, I maybe just want to kind of land on some, maybe not some full-fledged models of a kind of learning and knowledge and wisdom engagements that I don't necessarily want models so much as like what would be aspects of different modes of learning, wisdom, relationship, all that kind of stuff that would exist that aren't this education model. What are some aspects there? Because you list all the things that mark the problems of education now. You give a bunch of points in your book, and I love that. So that maybe we can just come up with some points at the end just to leave
people with.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something I'm thinking about a lot and trying to make a new school for younger people here in Durham. I think one big aspect that's missing in normal schools and universities is the idea that young people, kids, children, teenagers should be trusted to make decisions for themselves about their lives and what they want to learn. There's a kind of ingrained adult supremacy in the education system where kids are seen as needing the direction of enlightened adults to figure out how they should engage with the world. I think an alternative kind of education system would dismantle that, those adult supremacist ways of being, and have a kind of baseline of trust for young people. I think another important aspect is to get rid of that kind of vertical imaginary. And that, I think part of that is entrusting kids. I think part of the vertical imaginary is seeing adults as people who have risen up this kind of vertical educational pathway in contrast with kids who are seen as at the bottom. But it's more than that. Also, I think another part of that kind of vertical imaginary is the way that it like abstracts people from the like embodied place-based situations of their lives, where the kind of knowledge people are supposed to learn through education is seen as something universal that is valid everywhere, like as seen from like a zero point floating above the earth, instead of that, we should see knowledge as always created in particular places by particular people for particular political purposes. Reground our understandings of knowledge production in the places and with the embodied people who we're learning with. Yeah, along the lines of trusting kids, like trust kids to be able to learn, but also trust them to engage as political actors, as having political agency. So by giving kids a say, or not just a say, but like real decision-making power in how schools and universities are run. So get rid of some kind of hierarchy of administrators and instead make schools and universities worker and student run, democratically cooperative worker and student owned places that are run by radically democratic assemblies. It would save a lot of money getting rid of the administrative class. if you see students' work as real work and value it as such, they can be part of a worker cooperative with adults who are part of the space.
Those are all awesome. And like, give me a sense of like, oh yeah, like why not? You know, I mean, it sounds all very sensible. I want to maybe like offer a few and then like we can talk for just a little bit more and then we'll stop. Cause this is like the most exciting part of the conversation. We probably should have just done it right in the beginning for me, like where it's creating, you know, in Waldorf schools, like kids don't learn to read right away. Like they don't learn to read and write until they're like 8 or something like that. And some of them don't even learn then until they express the desire. But of course, if they want to before then, they can. So it's like right in the beginning, there's that inculcation of let's engage with language in this specific way. And, you know, once you learn to read, you can't learn to unread. So the world becomes populated by the presence of meaning everywhere once you learn to read. And so who do you become if you're not forced into at a specific age, you know, that exactly in the beginning. So I love the freedom to direct in the way that you're talking about in a really radical way early on. I was thinking about like, wouldn't it be great to teach people, you know, I tried to do this when I was teaching. But the problem is you always fail when you're in the institution because you're always working upstream against every other class that the students are in. But it is like when you read this story or this essay, like what's happening in you, not just like how do we interpret this politically, contextually, reducing it to whatever social function it might have, but like trying to meet the student as an individual who's having experiences as they encounter art, you know, that to me was very exciting because I'm not saying don't do any of the political interpretation or whatever, but just at the same time, recognize that they're individuated responses and they're all also valid. And then, you know, thinking about the ways that people learn all sorts of things that don't seem valuable. Like there's this great book called Cold Iron, which is about the occupational lore of fishermen. And it's about like the things that fishermen believe and say to each other, particularly in Ireland, and how like all these things have deep value and feeling, you know, some of them have faded away by now, but have had deep value and feeling to fishermen. And like from the outside, it just seems like nonsense. But like what actually is being experienced there without being like, well, I can explain this by saying this or this, but, you know, like it's the joke I always make about anthropologists where, you know, an indigenous person will be like this, you know, I was passed out on a beach and a wolf vomited foam on me and then told me how to avoid smallpox. And then the anthropologist is like, oh, so what does that tell me about the kinship structure? You know, I'm just like, why are we trying to slot it in there? Like there's so much in that story. Don't you want to hear about the talking wolf? You know, like that kind of stuff where things are taken to have value without being reduced again to a sort of function, but trying to understand that value in its own terms. And I think that would be really great and exciting to me too, if that happened in universities. And I think or not universities, wherever that should happen. And I think that you've touched on some of that with some of the models you point out at the indigenous learning and Black people's communal learning outside of universities and organizational spaces and all that. I think it's amazing as a gay guy, like you learn so much just from being in culture, you know, and that education is valuable to me. And I hate the reduction of it to like street smarts or the idea that it be, you know, just turned into queer theory or something like that. Like, yeah. So like, I love all your examples and it's like sparked these examples in me as I'm, you know, listening to you. Anybody that's trying to think of a new way to like learn and engage, like I bet all kinds of things like come to them out of their own miserable or abrasive experiences with their own education in academia that like we could start, you know, doing something around. Yeah.
That's what I think is hopeful about this kind of organizing and thinking that everybody has experiences that exceed the kinds of boxes that we're put into or that these school and university and work institutions try to put us into, that we're always failing in some way to conform to the exact kind of way of feeling and relating that these normative positions expect us to be. You can talk to anybody really about those kinds of non-normative or failure kinds of experiences, and that can be a basis of destabilizing their sense of being stuck, and like opening up, talking about opening up possibilities of other ways of doing things, that you can always find connections there. Yeah, and instead of like short-circuiting that kind of description of their experiences with a turn to some kind of explanation or normative evaluation, if we like stick with a conversation where we're really trying to understand someone else's experience, can always go further. Yeah, and in doing that, you're like doing something different. You're enacting a different kind of way of relating with other people.
Well, listen, I would love to talk with you about this even more, and I'm really excited for the school you're working on and for everything you're doing, and the kinds of enthusiastic liberation you offer people through your writing and your efforts, Eli Meyerhoff. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Connor. I really enjoyed being in conversation with you.
All right, great. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye now.